Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Tacoma resident Dr. Joey Hulbert. Dr. Hulbert has an extensive list of accomplishments and activities, all driven by his gently passionate commitment to all things environmental, and for today's conversation, most specifically for trees. Dr. Hulbert is a graduate of Washington State University, has a master's from Oregon State, and a PhD in plant pathology from the University of Pretoria in South Africa. I think it's fair to say that here in Washington, we love our trees. A big chunk of the evergreen state description comes from our trees. Yet our trees are suffering from climate change, among other environmental challenges. The specific causes, the extent, the future, those questions, that's why we're talking to Dr. Hulbert today. So here we go. So welcome to Climate Talk, and we're talking to Dr. Joey Hulbert. He's with the Forest Watch program at Washington State University. So it's okay if I call you Joey, I think. Dr. Hulbert, is that all right?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay. Sometimes it feels a little awkward. Maybe it's a generational thing for me to refer to PhDs by a kind of a nickname like Joey, but I'll get over it. So so a little bit of personal background from you. How did you, what led you to do the work that you're doing now?
Very good question. My story kind of started in Kansas. I grew up in Kansas where my dad was a professor. And then in 2005, when I was going to start undergraduate, we moved to Washington. And because I was moving from Kansas to Washington, I had to study trees.
Yeah.
So that started my, that move really is what put me on this path towards forestry. And during my undergrad, I had the privileged to work in some plant disease labs. And so after I finished my degree at Washington State University, I was able to merge plant disease and forestry in kind of a tree health level. And so I studied sudden oak death, which is a disease of trees, primarily oaks, tan oaks in California and Oregon. And so that was what I ended up studying for a master's degree at Oregon State University. And then I became very familiar with a group of microbes called Phytophthora, which is a Greek word that means plant destroyer. Mm-hmm. And this is the group that causes sudden oak death. There's an organism in this group that causes this disease, sudden oak death. And I got really interested in this group. And then that took me to South Africa to do a PhD and continue studying this group, but in a completely different system. In a biodiversity hotspot in South Africa.
Yeah. So
and then after that, I returned to the U.S.
Yeah. Okay. So it's fairly much of a leap from Washington State to South Africa. So I'm just curious, what was it that attracted you about doing your PhD there?
That's a really good question. When I was wrapping up my master's degree, I was in communication with some people in New Zealand. So I was already considering going abroad. But the project in New Zealand was very defined, and I didn't have a lot of freedom to decide what I got to study and things like that. But it was, again, on the same group, Phytophthora. But then at the end, I went to a conference in Salt Lake City, and I met my PhD advisor there. And he said, hey, if you come to South Africa, you can kind of study whatever you want, and, okay. and you'll get a really great degree. And so so that's really... I had an amazing opportunity to study with someone who's really brilliant and get to study and create my own project. So that's why I chose to go to South Africa.
Yeah, that academic freedom. And just as an aside, my father's a New Zealander. In fact, I lived in New Zealand for a while when I was a kid. And you would know way more about this than I do, but I think there are a lot of species in New Zealand that are sort of unique to New Zealand in terms of trees. I know my father was very proud of his knowledge of all the different kinds of trees and the woods and the various greens and so on and so forth. So maybe something to put in your future somewhere to go down there.
Yeah, I still would love to get down there. A few of my friends from South Africa, it was a really international program where I did my PhD, and a couple of the guys that I did my PhD with are now in New Zealand studying tree health, where there's a bunch of tree health issues there as well.
Well, just a little further aside, I mean, they say Wellington is the coolest little capital in the world, and I've been there, and it is an amazing place to go. So good luck on making that part of your future. So, so you're the Washington State Puyallup Research and Extension Center. I'm kind of curious, where is that in Puyallup, and what do you guys do there?
Yeah, it's great. So I live in Tacoma. I'm, you know, have the privilege to learn and explore and research and study and discover, you know, on the traditional homelands, the Coast Salish peoples, and the specifically the Puyallup tribe Indians, the homelands of the Puyallup tribe. And having that privilege and living in Tacoma is really, really awesome. But the coolest part is that there's this really neat research center just 20 minutes down the road. So we drive, I usually get on I-5 and then exit on Pioneer Ave, or exit towards Pioneer Ave. So instead of taking Riverside Drive, I'll just take Pioneer Ave all the way down. And then it's probably like a mile past Canyon Road when you actually get to our research center. And that research center is amazing space. It's been there since the 1920s. It's like almost as old as main campus in Pullman. But it's really just a little gem. We have a bunch of field trials. We have really nice greenhouses. We have all these facilities for hosting tours and conferences. And then we have labs. And so I spend a lot of time between the lab, where we do a lot of research on tree health issues there in Puyallup. But then we also have a bunch of trees we're growing in greenhouses and outside. So I'd love to host you. Show you around anytime.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, in fact, I one of my daughters born in Puyallup, and I always am proud to be from Washington, be able to pronounce Puyallup properly. So it's a pretty special town, and sounds like a great facility there. So the thing that led me to reach out to you initially was Western Red Cedar Dieback. But one of the things I'm kind of think I'm hearing from you is that you're area of interest extends actually beyond Western Red Cedars. It's not just Western Red Cedars. Is that in terms of your interest? Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I've learned a lot about Red Cedar and from Red Cedar as well. And I really, really cherish Red Cedar because it's so important to our culturally, to the peoples, the indigenous peoples of the Northwest. It has, you know, it's a really special tree, but yeah, we're kind of chasing money all the time. And sometimes we get funding to work on Red Cedar, and sometimes we get funding to work on other issues that are emerging. So lately we've been working a lot on maples and a disease affecting our maple trees.
So the thing I'm interested, so let's just hang in there with Western Red Cedar here for a bit anyway. So my understanding is there is a dieback going on. So what's the deal? What's happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, a lot of people have asked this question too, and even Governor Inslee has expressed concern about Western Red Cedar, asked this question to some scientists at University of Washington. And so it is getting the attention of a lot of people, and a lot of people are concerned. And the short answer is we think it's related to the longer and hotter droughts that we're experiencing every year. So since 2015, when we had a really particularly hot and dry summer, we've seen a number of trees where they completely die, or maybe they just, the top will die. And right now the general consensus is this is linked to the changes in climate, or the differences in the summers that we're having in the Northwest. But there's still a lot of other factors that are affecting the health of Red Cedar that we need to investigate and understand better. But because it's such an important species culturally, we don't want to give up on it. We want to find solutions and try and keep it for future generations and keep access and availability of this species. So we're actively looking for, you know, where is the tree dying back? Where is it healthy? And then where do you think it will do well in the future? And how can we protect those populations in the future?
Well, that sounds like a really challenging situation to me because it's sort of like there's no cure for drought. I mean, we don't have the ability to have droughts or not have droughts. So if droughts are causing this problem, what can we do in terms of protecting those trees?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Certainly, there's things you can do on the land to reduce water stress on certain trees. You know, you might actually thin the forest a little bit in areas where you want all that water to be available for the red cedar. But you can also go down the route of breeding, and so it might be possible to breed more drought tolerant populations by selecting some from southern provinces where it's a little drier, but they've adapted. And intentionally selecting trees and breeding them together based on their ability to cope with drought. That might be another possible solution. It's a really ethical question, and I'm glad you asked, because in the face of changing climate, how much energy and investment can we put towards keeping it as things are, you know? And that's a really ethical question. And this particular species is one that we need to try a little harder to preserve, I think, because of the cultural relevance. Since time immemorial, it's provided gifts to indigenous communities around the Northwest. It's considered a really generous species because of all the gifts, and it's really important. And we'd like to see that continue into the, you know, for future generations, that access and that generosity. And so that's particularly why we should, you know, not give up on red cedar yet, even though we're certainly challenged by this pressing changes in our climate.
So, you said a little earlier a consensus developing around drought being the problem. So, can we say with certainty that drought is the primary contributor to this problem? I heard you make allusions to me, well, there's some other issues, but can we say that with certainty?
I cannot, but there might be other researchers that have a little more data that concretely links it to the drought. There is some really good collaborators. The reason I mentioned consensus is because there's a lot of other folks looking at this and trying to understand what's going on. There's particularly a group of physiologists that study water relationships and the relationships of plants with water and things like that. And so they have probably stronger evidence to confirm or deny that it's related to drought. But you know, it there's a lot of reasons that we're thinking it's drought. There's, you know, forest pathologists and forest entomologists have looked for insects and diseases that might be associated, and they haven't seen them on wide scale. So it seems like on certain level, you know, in certain sites, you might have one tree that's infected and one tree that's not. But the other factor is that we're seeing this dieback throughout the whole natural range of Western red cedar. So because it's like so widespread and uniform, it does seem like it's a big, a big change, like in a longer and hotter drought in the region.
So I was going to ask you about the range thing. So just to be sure I understand correctly, that basically the Western Red Cedars don't have any place to go hide. It's wherever their habitat is, or their range, as you refer to it, there's problems that have been seen. Is that right?
Well, that's, I guess when I refer to the range, I'm talking about there's places in, you know, Montana, and there's places in Idaho, there's places in Northeast Washington, and then down here in Western Washington, California, Oregon coast, British Columbia, but not, there's still certainly places like higher up in the Cascades where they seem to be doing fine still, you know. There are a lot of older trees with dieback if you go up towards Rainier, but a lot of what we're seeing is limited to the lower elevations. So even though we're seeing dieback kind of in different areas throughout the whole range, there's certainly places on smaller scales within the range that are doing fine. And so, yeah, it's more complex. Climate is changing, but there's still a lot of microsite variation, and there's still certain areas that aren't feeling the heat as much as others, for example.
Gotcha. So that makes sense, and I was guilty of possibly pushing you into making a generalization about something. You can't make a generalization there. So this is just a little bit of an aside. You made a reference to thinning, and I'm just wondering. So the trees that are dying anyway, is there any way of harvesting those trees and getting some use out of them, or is that a bad idea?
No, I absolutely think that's critical. There's each land managers do it a little bit differently. For example, Pierce County Parks, they prefer to keep the material on site, so they might chip it up and use it for other purposes, like a trail or something like that. But if you do have the relationship with someone who can carve that material into something useful, then they may be interested in receiving those trees. And I think that's something we should think about is like, okay, we have to take out this red cedar because now it's a hazard, because it's dead, right? And so what can we do with this material? And I do know, if it's particularly large, then yes, there's definitely someone who wants it for some carving purpose or some traditional use that it's harder to find access to those really old big trees. So I do think there's a lot of opportunity to utilize that material still, and it really comes down to the relationships. And if anyone wants to email me with an inquiry like, hey, we have this tree that's coming down, do you know anyone that would want it? I would welcome that and do my best. From the relationships that we have, it does sound like if it's a medium-sized tree or a small tree, there's a little less interest from the carving side, but there still might be a lot of interest from the bark, for example. So cedar bark is harvested routinely for basket weaving and textiles and a lot of other uses.
I know that just as a layperson, that cedar has been very valuable in building and related things in the past. So are these red cedars, are these trees that were logged over time, or were they not appropriate for that?
Now, red cedar, yeah, very good question. And I love to talk about the legacy of the Northwest and the industrial kind of heritage that we have in forestry. So Tacoma alone, it used to be timber capital of the world at one point, where we had 9 mills along the waterfront, and we're pumping out trees on the and lumber on the and timber on the rail system, and that's really important heritage for Tacoma. And I love to think about how privileged I am to be studying trees and get to live and work in this place that was kind of where timber was a big part of it. Red cedar is definitely a huge part of our timber legacy in the Northwest. It is a really durable wood, and it splits very easily. Shingles, we used to cover our roofs with shingles that were red cedar shingles. We moved away from that because of the fire hazard of having a wood roof. But you'll still see a lot of houses with these kind of planks, these cedar planks, or these sometimes referred to as shakes. So cedar planks, shakes, or shingles, are still commonly used because it's a great wood. It's really durable. It kind of resists decay and insects better than a lot of our other wood. And so, for example, in our ra we have raised beds in our garden, they're wood barriers that keep soil intact, and those are all made of cedar because it is durable and can last through that kind of favorable for fungal growth conditions.
So is Western Red Cedar being actively logged right now anywhere that you know of?
Absolutely. It's a more niche market. You're not going to find big timbers for construction and houses, but if you're going to buy fencing material, you're most likely buying cedar, and that's not necessarily. I'm not sure how much of it's being harvested on the western side of Washington, but I know in Idaho it's a big market, and there's entire mills that are just purely dedicated to cedar. For example, Troy, Idaho, just kind of over the border from Pullman in Moscow, maybe 20 miles from Pullman, there's a cedar mill, and I think they specialize in wood, in fencing materials and some of these other kind of more specialized uses where you need a really durable wood that isn't going to decay as quickly as others. So again, other examples might be your deck might be made out of cedar, but clearly your fences, your garden beds, some building materials, but also a lot of our cultural resources, like some totems, historically really important for canoes and transportation because of that durability. And yeah, we used to, the Native Americans built plank houses with it because it splits very easily, nice straight long boards fairly easily. So you could make, walls and roofs and things like that fairly easy.
So, looking ahead a little bit, I mean, so is it possible to estimate what the future of these trees is, given the fact that more than likely we're going to continue to see climate change become more of a challenge? So is there hope for these trees?
Yeah, it's a good question. Cedar's for a long time been a rare resource for, at least old cedar. It's becoming very difficult to find. Now Native Americans that are building canoes will also use fiberglass and things like that to substitute and to have a little bit of a mix, but part of that is because you can't find these big old timbers that you used to be able to find. So yeah, we're probably likely to continue to see less available Western red cedar. However, it's possible too that we're only seeing this dieback now because of the last five years, where maybe in 10 years from now, those trees that are establishing now in these drier conditions might do fine in the future.
I
It's
see.
just we're seeing this dieback of trees that established during a pretty wet period. The past, 90 years since the Dust Bowl, for example, have been pretty wet and in great conditions for trees. And so we might only just be seeing the dieback of trees that established in really favorable growing conditions, but all the trees that are establishing now may be better prepared to survive through drier climates. So I can't say for sure if we're really going to lose or if red cedar is declining or the availability of red cedar will decline, but we are certainly seeing a lot of trees that are unhealthy and a lot of trees dying year to year, and that's gotten a lot of people concerned. So it is unusual amount of dieback, but it's hard to say if this is going to be the trend going forward or if this is kind of just where we are right now in this climate, in this environment.
I've gotten to saying that the climate doesn't change in a straight line. There's so much variability, and who knows, depending on how it plays out. I mean, we could end up wetter sometime in the future. It's hard to predict those things. So I'm glad we've got scientists like you watching the store, so to speak, to keep track of how we are doing and how the trees are adapting and what we can do possibly to mitigate things. So you and when I was chatting with you just before we went on air, you mentioned maples, and there's another tree that I'm really interested in. It's madrones, arbutus, I think some people call them. I grew up in Southern Oregon, and we called them madronas down there, and I'm not sure why that was, but we did. But they're a pretty amazing tree. But I wanted to ask you, and this is just an off-the-cuff question. I go over on Vashon Island, and there's some pretty big groves of those madrones over there, and I've seen a lot of those trees that have just turned black. What's going on with those trees?
That's a great question. Yeah, Pacific madrone is really, really another really iconic species to the Northwest. And it's something that we actually research a lot at WSU and Puyallup. My colleague Marianne Elliott and our collaborator Michael Yadrick from Seattle Parks and Recreation, they lead a program called the Arbutus Army. And it's Army for, which is shorthand for the scientific name Arbutus menziesii. So it's ARME. And I encourage anyone that's listening to join that community if you appreciate Madrone. We try and bring together guest speakers and keep people that love Madrone like you kind of up to date on all the things. But Marianne at WSU and Puyallup is really one of the authorities on Madrone health. She did her PhD at University of Washington and described some of the fungi that cause this black cankers on the branches. Mm-hmm. But I think the black you're referring to is what we think of as leaf blight. And so I think I've heard them described as like scabs or shadows on the landscape, because sometimes during certain times of the year, the whole tree will just look gray and black, or all the leaves will look, diseased and blighted. And I think there's a number of different fungi that are involved in that. And that's one of the projects we have going right now, is trying to identify all the different communities in a healthy and unhealthy Madrone leaf. But generally, it's probably slowing the growth of the tree down, but it doesn't, in many cases, the tree will drop its leaves and then a new flush, or maybe two new flushes, will come out that year. And so it's like a seasonal blight, if you will. But it does seem like it's inside the leaves, so inside the stem. So every year is going to keep happening. Yeah. Really good question. And it's something that we really enjoy studying. It's one of those things that's really hard to find funding for, because aside from you and I, who just love this iconic tree in the Northwest, there isn't a timber company or someone who's using it industrially or commercially that wants to fund research to keep it healthy, right?
Yeah, I understand. Well, it is good to know that, because when I was looking at those groves, I mean, it's like these trees are screwed. I mean, how could they ever come back from this? But clearly, from what you just said, they do. And by the way, I want to acknowledge, you're the first person I've ever heard say the word arbutus. And so I mispronounced it the first time I tried. I just saw the spelling and went back to my high school Latin class and pronounced it that way. But
that's so nice. I'm not sure I pronounced it correctly. So in Canada and British Columbia, they often refer to it as arbutus rather than Madrone or Madrona. But here, what's common, you could say Madrone or Madrona. I think, this tree grows all the way down to California.
Yeah.
There's similar species in Latin America, where maybe is where Madrona originated. There's a little information about that in the vernacular and the terminology on the arbutusarmy.org webpage.
Okay, we do have show notes, and so I'll put that link in the show notes so people can find it there too if they want to. And you'd also mentioned maples, so we are getting close to the end here. But just are there problems with the maples too?
Yeah, we're seeing the emergence of a disease called sooty bark disease in the Northwest, and this is primarily affecting our maples, but a number of other species like horse chestnut and Pacific dogwood, and we found it on a European beech, and some of the other species that grow commonly on our streets in our cities. And so this seems to be it's a disease that is emerging as an issue now, again, because of climate change. But in this case, in contrast to the red cedar, this one is closely linked to a fungus called Cryptostroma corticale. And so we think that this fungus has been present in our trees for a very long time, and the trees have been surviving just fine with this fungus. It's been living as an endophyte inside the trees, not really causing much damage. But now when the trees become stressed from longer and hotter droughts, and the climate is more favorable for fungal growth, so it's warmer, many more days that are warm and wet And that's just great for a fungus. So the combination of a tree stress and this favorable growing conditions for this fungus have led to this emergence as an issue in a disease. And so now if you drive down Ravenna Boulevard towards Green Lake in Seattle, you'll see a number of dying maples. And we think it's related to the emergence of this disease. And so the story kind of began for me personally in 2020 when Seattle Parks and Rec reached out and said, hey, we're having a lot of maple tree health issues and we keep seeing this fungus on this tree. And they worked with these incredible people at Bartlett Tree, experts, I forget what, Bartlett Tree Research Group, and they confirmed as the same fungus on all these different species.
Wow.
And so that's when we started looking at it. And we have a project right now in Tacoma where we're trying to investigate whether trees in the hotter areas of Tacoma are more vulnerable or more diseased than trees in the cooler area. And that's a community science project. So this spring, when you can tell which species the tree is when they have their leaves again, there'll be a lot of opportunity if any listeners want to get involved in the research and help us map where trees are healthy and where they're unhealthy and collect samples and things like that.
Well, that's a great offer. And I do think it's in our nature, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, to love our trees. I certainly talk to a lot of folks that enjoy and appreciate and plant trees. And so that's a great resource. So, you know, one of the thoughts that occurred to me, climate change has impacts that it's difficult to foresee. It's more like, in so many cases, we have to deal with the impacts after they start becoming evident. And the fungus that you're talking about there seems like that's an example of that. So it's been there all the time. Climate's changing. So it changes the virulence or whatever you want to call it of that particular fungus. And I'm just going to draw a quick metaphor. I mean, this is true for us as human beings, too. I mean, we don't know really what's coming, and possibly there's going to be infectious diseases that go into areas that they didn't used to be in, and they're going to affect us as human beings, just like there are the trees. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, this disease has been brewing in our forest for a long time, and we had no idea until recently. And so it's a good example of the, in that metaphor is very appropriate. It's hard to predict what's gonna happen, but we're really good at solving problems, and that's pretty much what our lab does at WSU and Puyallup, is try and understand what's going on and then try and find solutions and ways to cope with this change. I do want to encourage the listeners to follow our work and to keep an eye out on the Forest Health Watch program, which is a community science effort to kind of understand how trees and climate are interacting and how changes in the climate are affecting the health of our trees and then ultimately affecting the health of our communities. And so one way that people can get involved is by contributing to the research or by engaging with us and helping share the research and things like that. And so more information about that is at foresthealth.org. You're also welcome to email me, or if you're willing to share my email in the notes, that would be valuable.
Absolutely.
And I appreciate that.
Yes. Well, thanks for that offer. And so often I hear people say, well, what can I do? And so there you go. There's something very specific that people can do that's different than just say, well, send us a check, which is what a lot of organizations do. So we'll make sure that that's in the notes. Anything else that I haven't asked you about or that you'd like to throw in here, Joy, before we finish up?
Yeah, I think oftentimes we come off as very doomy and gloom, doom and gloom.
Yeah.
We're talking about climate change. It's affecting our forests, affecting our communities. But that's okay to feel that kind of anxiety or to feel bad because of that and to grieve for these trees a little bit. And that emotion is natural. But at the same time, we're not going to lose our forests. They might just look a little different in the future. we're going to keep trying to adapt and continue to keep our forests healthy and our communities healthy as best we can. But what's central to all of what we're learning is that trees are critical, and regardless of the species that's there now, we want to keep a tree there in the future, for example. And so,
Well,
it's really a community effort and trying to understand what's happening now and what we can do in the future.
yeah, so I really appreciate you making this a community thing, because it does this idea of the citizen scientist who is helping to gather data and that sort of thing. I'm also grateful to you and other scientists who are keeping their eye on things. So there's nothing like knowing what's really going on to make our responses so much more accurate. So Dr. Joey Hilbert, thank you so much for being with Climate Talk. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, John. It was my privilege. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Hilbert for sharing his deep understanding of the lives of our trees here in the Northwest, the joys and challenges facing those trees, and what a changing climate means to them. Dr. Hilbert is Program Director of Forest Health Watch, which is an effective way for ordinary folks who are wondering what they can do. A resource is a citizen scientist program that is not only a good thing to do, it's fun and fulfilling at the same time. Just do a search for Forest Health Watch or check out our program links. Find the site and have fun while doing good. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached, so you can join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember, all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.